Hello everyone, I'm Tom Denford, co-founder of IDComms. Welcome to episode 31 of Media Snack Meets. Recorded each month in New York, we get to meet the individuals and organizations doing great work to inspire success and drive change within the global media and marketing industry. In each episode, we find out what is behind that success, what it takes to make change in the industry, and what the rest of us can learn from that experience. My guest for this episode is Tom Goodwin, the author, provocateur, and award-winning voice in marketing and innovation. By day, you can find Tom working at the publicist group media agency Zenith Media, where he is head of innovation based here in New York. Otherwise, he's likely to be en route to delivering a keynote address at one of the leading marketing conferences around the world. Tom calls himself a pain in the ass with good intentions, which is his humble way of acknowledging that he is certainly one of the industry's most prolific and articulate thinkers. For example, if you follow him on Twitter, and you should, you will witness an incessant stream of humorous observation, startling lateral thinking, and tons of simply good ideas written succinctly and unpretentiously. I have always enjoyed time with Tom for being one of the most skilled talkers I know, and therefore he makes a wonderful podcast guest. Tom has the ability to talk as if he's reading aloud, with a calm, consistent rhythm that allows his ideas space to form as he's speaking them. And it's a remarkable skill that I hope you enjoy in this interview. In 2018, he published his first book, Digital Darwinism, which explores how businesses are coping with transformation in a digital age to be better companies. It has also been scientifically proven that Tom has the best hair on the internet, which I think he has already registered as a trademark. In this episode, we discuss how we should be radically simplifying digital marketing. Where does Tom get his inspiration from? What happened when he recently interviewed Seth Godin? And what is his advice for marketers for the year ahead? You can check the show notes for this episode at mediasnackpodcast.com, including a full transcript and links to resources that Tom recommends that you read. But without further delay, please enjoy this entertaining and mind-broadening interview with Tom Goodwin. Tom, welcome to Media Snack Meets.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We've been trying to get together for a little while, haven't we? Some listeners might recall, I might have mentioned this on Media Snack before, is that I think we did record a show like 2 years ago in London, and you had a really bad cold.
Yes.
And then we completely cocked up on the audio recording, and we never managed to put it out. And we've been trying to schedule it ever since, I think.
It's going to be good to come back and emulate some of that success from before.
That was pre-book, I think.
I think it was.
You were still writing.
I think I was. I had the ideas of the book in my head, and I think you asked me about it, and I didn't do a very good job of explaining it. So maybe today I'll be better. I'm not sure.
So we'll come on. I want to talk about the book because it's been out a kind of year or so, but that's done phenomenally well, and it's really interesting. And now you're flying all over the world talking about that and other things, which is keeping you very busy. As I've explained in the intro, apart from being a successful marketing book writer, which is not an easy thing to have achieved, you work at Zenith Media,
yes,
based here in New York,
yeah,
hence the accent, right? As EVP Innovation, is that right?
Yes, I like you're sort of frowning as you're asking the question, yeah. So I know that you're going to ask me what that means.
Mean?
Yes. It's worth noting that this is a word that gets used a lot, and it has absolutely sort of no defined meaning in a way that really connects with people. I think often it's a kind of spirit, if anything. It's become sort of synonymous with this need to demonstrate to the world that somehow you get change and that somehow technology is making a profound difference. And it's become a sort of experimental unit that's kind of bolted onto the side of agencies or clients. And I think my take on it is actually that's the wrong way to go about it, and to treat it as this kind of garnish or this kind of double R on Friday afternoons of the kind of calendar is massively inappropriate, actually. We need to take it much more seriously. But that's extremely difficult to do. So I think part of my role is to try and elevate the kind of conversations that we have and move up to more senior clients and get people to take this as much more of a sort of existential threat or profound opportunity, more than being an opportunity to give a startup $25,000 and get your name in TechCrunch.
What does it mean to you, though? Because innovation is one of these really horrible cliches, overexposed and understood words. Understood is that a thing? But that's what you do, though. You're out there. What's the purpose of that? Trying to just get people to open their minds to think a little bit
differently? And is there a structure to that? Is it really, is it a creative kind of feel it, freeform thing? Or is there a framework of innovation that you can really follow?
I think when you look at different types of change that happen within businesses and happen within design processes, most changes are quite incremental. So they kind of follow quite linear patterns and they involve lots and lots of established ways of thinking. And it's almost like a sort of evolutionary sort of funnel where things improve towards a sort of common goal. And I think there are periods in a design process where you see this leap of faith and you see this kind of jump across to a totally different way of thinking about things or a totally different way to solve the same problem. And that for me is kind of innovation. Like for me, it's about getting different types of people and different types of thinking and thinking about technology in new ways. And then having a complete step change in the way that you go about that. You know, our industry is kind of obsessed with the sort of current paradigm of CPMs and measurements on spreadsheets and optimization. And I think...
I'm licking my lips. That's the stuff that gets me excited.
To some extent, everything I do is almost the antithesis of that stuff. So it's actually saying that we can't measure how successful this is or that this does involve huge amounts of genuine risk or that this has never been done before. So there is no case study. So in a way, this spirit of what I do and what actually I do about getting people to be very open-minded to radically different ways to do our jobs. And that's quite difficult.
Yeah. There's the work that you do at Zenith Media, right? So, I mean, most listeners will know that's one of the world's largest big media agency networks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got the book and you've got your, you know, your platform or your audience community, whatever you call it, where you have a voice and you talk about these things. And lots of them, those aren't related necessarily to Zenith Media and that. And then you're out there talking. You get hired to travel around the world and deliver kind of speeches to inspire people. Is that around innovation? Is that, do you feel that's your... thing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the role that I do in the broader world that's less attached to Zenith is much more about a wider aperture on innovation and more general business changes and marketing changes and retail changes. And it's kind of looking further ahead into the future. So the kind of conversations that I might have as part of that environment are things like the future of mobility or what should cities become or how does governance change in the future. And I think when I'm thinking more about my role at Zenith, it's much more about what's the meaning of that and what does it mean for our clients' businesses. And I'm quite lucky to have different relationships with our clients through Zenith. So the kind of conversations I'm normally having and the people that I'm speaking to are not there because of my incredible knowledge about CPMs or DSPs or CRM platforms or tech stacks, because I don't really understand any of that. I'm there to try and bridge the broader changing world and what that means for these people's roles. And often those people are CMOs or perhaps sort of strategic planners more than they are sort of media people. But there's no sort of tension there between them. I mean, what I learn from being on planes and shopping malls and talking to interesting people at conferences is very much material that then gets synthesized into, you know, my more everyday job.
Yeah. I'm just, as you're saying that, I'm just thinking, you know, this podcast is not going to open up a new audience for you. I mean, like most people that listen to this will be familiar with you or something that you've written.
Maybe.
Or something that you've done.
Yeah,
right.
You never
know. So we're not... people kind of know what Tom Goodwin is. I think the first thing I want to talk about is a lot of listeners will have been to conferences, heard either you talk or people like you talk, and it's energizing and motivating and fun. And it's a kind of, you know, it's a good stories to tell. It's a shared moment and all those, you know, like a really great speaker.
Yeah.
And then you get back to your desk like on the next Monday morning and it's the same thing. So how do you bridge that delta, I think you call it, between inspiring people on from a stage and then actually engendering some kind of change in the business?
Well, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I'm aware as I do this more that it's not getting any easier. So if anything, I've done a better job of coming to terms with the reality of the frustration. It's just hard. I think there's an interesting point of kind of generations, I think, where, you know, by definition, and this is something I posted on LinkedIn the other day, by definition, when you become sufficiently important that your voice is heard and perhaps you have a budget and that people will listen to you and follow the path that you set, by definition, you're probably quite old. And by quite old, I'm deliberately being vague, but you're probably at an age where you start having kids and you probably own a house. And then the moment that you have those fixed costs and those risks in your life, you also then have much less to gain, because actually at that point you start managing the decline of your career more than the ascent. And I think there's a sort of cruel irony, really, in the fact that the people that do come to conferences and sort of clap the most loudly and enthusiastically come up to you at the end and say that, you know, you were correct or that you were wrong or something, those normally are people that are probably three or four levels below the point where these decisions really get made. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when these people get older. Like, will they just age into conservatism? Will they realize that actually they are a product of an age where there was huge amounts of disruption and where small companies can come from nowhere to challenge big ones? And maybe they'll keep that spirit alive, but it's going to take a little bit of time. Yeah.
You know, media agencies have been run by the same handful of white middle-class British or American men for the last 15, 20 years. And that just hasn't really changed.
I mean,
it's changed a little bit in the last few years. We've seen some of the turnover of that. When you get to that level, I think that's your point, is that you're motivated to protect the status quo.
You're motivated, and it doesn't mean that these people are evil or they're stupid. It means that they're acting in their own interests and the interests of what's actually the mandate that they've been given from above. And generally speaking, our industry holistically is in a sort of managed decline as well, where generally speaking, it's about managing costs to ensure profitability is maintained rather than managing investment to make sure that growth is maintained. So that does create quite a difficult scenario. Like, I'm definitely aware that the most common thing that people say to me after my presentations is, well, it was great, but you didn't really tell me anything new. You just sort of connected the dots in a different way, and you were just sort of saying what we all think, but we're a bit afraid to say. And I find that interesting because it is completely right and is slightly offensive in its correctness. But it makes me realize the thing that I have going for me, which is different to other people, is actually I do have a degree of fearlessness. And actually that kind of comes from the way I was brought up. And it also comes from the fact that actually if I did lose my job tomorrow, like the worst case scenario is still kind of fine. Like, there's no kids that are going to get thrown out of school and there's no houses that are going to be taken away from me. And I think it's worth remembering that what has been useful to me has been fearlessness, and that perhaps that should be a characteristic that we look for in people that work around us as well.
Yeah. We've discussed on previous shows, we have this thing where we hire. Clearly, you've just immediately qualified yourself for. So in every single job brief are the words fearless, not reckless. Now, I don't like reckless people because they get you into trouble and they say things they're not supposed to and they overpromise and underdeliver. Yeah. But there's, I think it's a really, really good to have a fearless challenge.
Absolutely.
Of like authority, you know, not to be grounded enough to be able to stand your ground with the CEO and make a case. I love that.
I think intentions are very important to me. I can't remember if it's still in my Twitter bio, but at one point I called myself a pain in the ass with good intentions. And it's important. Like, there's a big difference between trolling, where you're being inflammatory to try and get people to notice you because you want attention, and being quite punchy and provocative because you are actually trying to start a debate or to listen from other people that know more, or to get people talking about something that we should talk about. And I think it would be great if we could do a better job of realizing that often people that are quite difficult and are challenging and are strong-minded, if their intentions are actually purely good, and there's a good chance that they will be, that's a very useful force, but it's something that people have to kind of manage somehow.
Yeah. What do you think is going on in the media agency world? Are agencies innovating? Is there innovation in media agencies? Are they stagnating? You know, we went down a rather dark path for a moment, didn't we? Talking about like they're managing their decline and all this kind of stuff, which I think is understood.
I didn't mean that to sort of sound depressing. I just think it's a good context to understand the sort of reality of the situation, because, you know, there are very few phone calls where the person's saying, hey, I'd like to spend more money with you this year and I'd like to be sure that we can give it to you in a way which is more profitable. So we have to be cognizant of the reality. The weird thing I think about the industry environment is we tend to do a lot of mirroring each other. So everyone's kind of in service of each other. So as an agency, we feel like we're somewhat indentured to our clients, the vendors, which is a horrible term, but the people that we work with to help invest our clients' money feel like they're somehow serving us. And I think that creates quite a sort of loop of complicitness in a way, where we feel like, who are we to challenge the client structure and who are we to challenge the spreadsheets that they fill in? So I think we have lots of good explanations for it. I just think that they're not good excuses. And I mean, I feel like sometimes I sound like an old person, but I grew up in an environment where as an agency, you were paid to be a trusted advisor. And the value that we added was to bring in outside opinions and to be fearless in telling the client that their, you know, proverbial baby was ugly. And I think somehow it doesn't feel like that anymore. And I think that's partly the sort of media side, and that's partly the modern age, and it's partly an overserved market. But it's a very ironic thing because we end up losing all of our value when we become easier to work with and more complicit, more compliant, sorry. And that's when we see the move towards sort of in-housing and it's sort of bringing other elements back from the agency. So we've entered this sort of very ironic sort of spiral almost. I think the trouble is that the current environment actually works quite well for a lot of people as well. So I don't think, I mean, we're kind of talking about it before, but I don't think most people over the age of 40 look at this industry and think this is terrible. There's an easy way to change it and I should be that person to do that. Like instead, you know, TV companies are quite happy with the fact that their viewership is declining because it means that their media becomes more scarce, it becomes more valuable. Like no one at a big TV company is thinking, how can I provide my stuff over the internet free of charge and then start making money from video-based addressable advertising? Because they know that's such a huge leap of faith and such a big risk that immediately they'd be fired for suggesting such a thing. So we probably, in theory, should see this sort of inflection point where the entire industry becomes very sort of digitally oriented and we think about media planning and buying in a totally different way. And we start thinking about words like programmatic in a positive way rather than a negative way, because it just means using algorithms to make good decisions.
And what do you think about that? You think that's possible? Is it to, you can bring that, because Ritson is absolutely convinced, I think we even had a bet about it, is the word programmatic was so toxic that it could never, ever be recovered and kind of positioned.
I think it probably needs a rebranding job, and probably the way to do it is to change the word. But it's strange
so
how...
So he's right.
I think he's right in terms of the branding of the word programmatic, but he's wrong if he thinks that the notion and the philosophy of programmatic...
No, he was just talking about the word.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
You've got to call it something else.
Some sort of snazzy company will come out with... I mean, addressable is a pretty crappy word. I don't know, they'll probably use AI. It'll just be AI-driven advertising and then everyone will think it's the future or something. But yeah, I mean, like all of these concepts should be very helpful to us, but somehow we shy away from having these conversations because we're worried that people will think that we're saying something different to what we're actually saying. So the entire world of media, I mean, you look at the magazine owners, they've done an absolutely terrible job of changing. Like they're terrified that the abundance of time that we spend online means that inventory tends to infinity, which means that prices tend to zero. And they continue to sort of operate their structures in a way that has digital departments and digital media sales executives. And they do everything that's wrong. I'm a very optimistic person and somehow my tone is quite negative at the moment, but I think we are at this sort of weird period of time that I call the interim of things, where we kind of have the business models and the structure and the processes and the culture of the past. And then we've sort of added to that legacy infrastructure, all of this modernity and tech stacks and algorithmic buying, but we've kind of added it to the kind of crumbling foundations of the past. And it's probably going to get a little bit worse for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then the whole thing will just start having existential cracks and sort of break quite quickly. And we'll suddenly enter a new paradigm where actually things are better for everyone. So we'll see that we get targeted with ads which are actually more helpful to us and more relevant to us, but they're not personalized because no one really wants personalization. We'll figure out a way that those ads will be worth more, so we'll see fewer of them, and because they're worth more, people will spend more money on production and make sure they're more they value our attention greater. And I think this will end up with lots of virtuous circles which work really well for everybody. I just think somehow people haven't seen that yet.
I think that's exactly right. The great test of that is, you know, the marketers saying, is this working? Are we selling more stuff? Are we growing share? But figuring out actually what does work and what doesn't work, doing more of that stuff.
Yeah.
That sets then all of us that were partying and high-fiving over kind of success of VC money coming into ad tech, thinking that was the future.
Yeah.
Greater complexity means greater money for everybody else.
Yeah.
No. We just go back to really simple things like what sells shampoo. people will come up with technologies driven by really simple principles, exactly as you're talking about. And those are things that marketers are going to want to buy.
I think so. And I think the wonderful thing is I've done quite a lot of thinking about this and I can't see that anyone loses from this. Like actually the interests of publishers, the interests of technology companies and platforms and brands and agencies and people, like every person on the planet, they're actually very aligned. So there's no logical way why it can't happen. I think somehow the ad tech thing became this thing where everyone felt vulnerable unless they were also making complicated charts with lots of logos. And people feel vulnerable if they don't appear to have a process which seems to be very, very technologically driven and complex. And you feel vulnerable if you don't have something that shows 29 different sources of data being smashed together and forming some big data sets that you then do snazzy things with. And actually... And I'm prepared to be completely wrong on this, and I'm prepared to seem like an idiot, but I think we massively overcomplicate things. And I don't actually think we need that much data. I don't actually think that the technology needs to be that significant. I don't even think we actually need to use as much attribution as we do, because I think most of it is nonsense. The number of times you see this incredibly complex way to establish someone that's quite interested in cars, you know, it'll use location data to scrape through someone's sort of recent Google Maps history to find out they've been to a car dealership. And actually, if you just find someone that's been on a car website, like, that's the same. Yeah. Just figure out they went on a car website, or if they're watching Top Gear on Amazon Prime, then they're probably quite interested in cars. Yeah. And actually, you know, most people will be buying cars based on brands that have formed opinions over decades in their life. So this idea that somehow we have to get so precise and so surgical about it, I think it's nonsense.
Yeah. This endless search for personalization, for attribution, for complete accountability.
Yeah.
You go, oh yeah, that never actually made sense, did it? Like that doesn't, it, of course that's not possible. As Bob Hoffman calls it, you know, these like sophisticated surveillance operations not serving anybody at all, other than the platforms and the infrastructure believes that that's what marketers want.
Yeah.
And marketers have been demanding it because they've been told that that's what they should demand. You know, it's, they've gone round and round in circles. I think that now they're pulling back is my observation slowly from that and realizing they need to invest some time in their brands a bit more.
I think that's where we're getting to. I mean, you would have more exposure to those kind of conversations that I have. My sense is that it's a bit like a kind of movement in architecture, like postmodernism, where for so long modernism was the kind of trendy new thing and you almost had to sort of build that way. Otherwise, everyone thought you were an idiot because they thought you were just naive and stupid and you hadn't learnt about this new technique. And then postmodernism came away and kind of because people were confident enough in modernism, they were able to sort of subvert it and to sort of retreat back to more traditional principles that actually worked for years. And I think we're seeing the same in the digital landscape, which is why I call it sort of post-digital, where for so long, if you didn't have a feed on, if you didn't have a presence on Twitter, people just assumed you'd never heard of Twitter. They didn't think that you'd decided against that. They thought you were ignorant. And for so long, if you didn't spend a lot of money on digital media, the assumption was that you were stupid. And I think we saw all of this sort of the glancing at each other and making sure that we were doing the same thing collectively, that you felt stupid if you didn't have tons of data and you felt stupid if you weren't doing everything that seemed modern. And then now we're getting to the point where people are happy to say no and to say no, knowing that they've tried it and knowing that the rest of the industry won't think they're stupid. And I think that could be a movement that sort of gathers momentum. Yeah. But there's a sort of vulnerability and simplicity as well. As an agency, I think we feel quite scared if we just make it seem like it's not that complex. You know, we have to stick in 25 different charts to show our strategic planning approach because you feel like that's what people buy money, you know, spend money on. Whereas actually, I just think being confident enough and empathetic enough and understanding people enough, people can buy that. It's just quite hard to demonstrate that with charts.
Yeah. I really like the interim of things. I think that is that a Goodwinism?
I think so.
That's got to be the next book. Because I think it's a really nice way of describing kind of where we are. And I agree, it's going to last a couple of years as the system almost purges itself of all of its complexity and we get back to actually listening to what marketers want and build around that again.
It has happened with every single technology that's ever existed. So steam engines were first used to pull up water to drive water wheels, and the first electrical motors were used to sort of replace steam engines in quite stupid ways. It's quite normal to go through this period where no one's really figured it out, and then we reconstruct for the new age. It just takes us quite a long time.
So. Yeah. Let's just talk about you for a second. So you did the book.
Yes.
Tell us, so for those that haven't read, Digital Darwinism. So that was about a year and a bit ago that
Something
came
like
out.
That. It's all about changing the world and change the matters. Yeah. Like, there's lots of people that go around saying 5G, Internet of Things, AI, image recognition, deep learning, blah, blah, blah. And it's almost like their job is to try and get us confused about stuff. And what I try to do is a very sensible, logical take on the changes that we should really be thinking about, the ones that we shouldn't be thinking about, and how companies can really do that. It's looking at sort of the notion of disruption, and I hate that word, but looking at companies that should have changed that didn't. It's looking at companies that did change and how they changed. So it's sort of designed to be a sort of manual to help people at all levels in business think about technology in a way that allows them to change for good.
I mean, following that Darwinism theme, yeah. Right? That's makes sense then when we start talking about the stuff that we were just talking about, which is we're in a bit of a mess, but it'll figure its way out at some point because... Yeah. You know, it's natural selection, right?
Yeah, I didn't like the title. The publisher gave me the title, and then because I couldn't come up with a better one, I had to learn to love it. And increasingly, I realize it's not a terrible title, even though it doesn't sort of feel that remarkable. But this idea that, I mean, evolution needs mutations, and it kind of needs errors, and it kind of needs there to be significant changes that happen. Otherwise, you do sort of die. And I think we need to be careful that we don't go around saying every industry is screwed, because the reality is that, you know, if you're an airline, like, you're probably fine right now. Like, you know, VR is not going to change the future of your business. Just make it easier to bloody change flights, for goodness sake. So it's not like everyone needs to be paranoid, but often the people that should be paranoid are not, and often the people that are paranoid shouldn't be. I'd like to think that my book is a useful guide through the degree to which people should be thinking about this and how to think about it. And it doesn't involve this whole, like, death and everything screwed kind of narrative. It just involves a kind of, let's be thoughtful and let's take our time and let's figure out the right time to jump on the right technology in the right way, and to do everything you do with a kind of relentless focus on the customer stroke people stroke consumers, because most of the innovation that's done more often than not is really about signaling to each other, which is something I can't stand. So, and just doing simple things well often as well.
Good. What's the most interesting or best comment you've had about the book? Is there the moments where you've just thought, oh, I'm glad I wrote that?
Well, you feel very vulnerable when you write a book. Like, I mean, I didn't go to school and have lots of people applaud me all day long saying I was clever. So you presume that you have no right to write a book and that other people have come up with the same concepts before, and that actually you haven't done enough research, and you presume that you've made massive errors and that you'll feel like an idiot. I never would have written a book if it wasn't for having a publisher that sort of approached me and sort of gave me the confidence to do it. So the main thing I've felt is relief that there are not lots of people that have sort of shouted at me saying I'm an idiot for writing it. People seem to find it quite funny, which is quite flattering. I slagged off management consultants quite a lot. Like, I do have this deep loathing of everything about that entire industry. And I presume that by being quite mean-spirited about consultants and being quite mean-spirited about Clayton Christensen, I thought there'd be a bit of a backlash. I thought there'd just be people that would sort of try and take me down. And I haven't heard that so far. So far, so good. I'll do more of that in the second book.
I hope they're reading it.
Yeah.
Have you finished promoting that?
It's a weird feeling when you finish a book, because you're obviously supposed to promote it, but I thought maybe this is shit, and maybe the more people that buy it, the more stupid I'll seem to be. So I just sort of let it sell itself, and it sold quite well. And now it seems quite strange to promote it. So I'll write a few articles that are based on the principles, just because I think they're quite interesting things to write. And it was never like a huge part of my job. Like, it was a kind of weekend and evening thing. So I've always been doing my job. So yeah, at the moment... I don't quite know how public this is supposed to be, but I spend most of my time working for Zenith in the US, but increasingly I kind of talk about the themes and the trends from Zenith across the world. And I'm doing more work for the kind of publicist group as well. Like, there is a realization that our industry does need to change and that people like me are quite good at getting people to think differently. So I'm doing various different things to try and create a culture of change within the group itself. But I think I can't be more specific than that.
No, I think I know what you're talking about. But the business has realized that there's a Tom Goodwin in the building, and that's quite that could be quite helpful.
Slowly. It's a very odd thing where you have everything in the world from most people not knowing you exist and certainly not caring that you exist and knowing nothing about you, which is great. But then there are sort of small pockets of people that seem to think that I must walk around sort of signing fans sort of breasts and stuff all day long and get noticed on the street. And that's not really true at all. But there is this weird situation where you can enter a room and sometimes people think that this wonderful thing has happened and I'm this notable sort of quote unquote thought leader that they're lucky to have in the room. And that happens very rarely. Sometimes people just seem quite visually irritated by the fact that I've come to a meeting, which is understandable and I get it. But more often than not, there's this weird thing where most people have not heard of you and you don't know if they should have. And then you can't quite figure out sort of how to behave in that room.
So that's nice. Then you have the opportunity to delight.
Yeah.
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 How do you consume content stuff? So you talk a lot,
yeah.
Right? You speak a lot, you write a lot.
Yeah.
You constantly putting things out there and challenging. Like, what's your approach to consuming stuff? Is it completely random or do you have certain go-to places?
I mean, it's basically my Twitter feed. And what I like about that is it's quite democratic, actually, Twitter. I think people don't realize that. But if someone writes a really good piece, like, it doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah.
Like, it certainly doesn't matter what gender they are, despite what people think. It doesn't matter what country they come from. Like, obviously, if you have followers, it means it's more likely to spark in the first place. But I actually think that once something sparks, like, if you write something well, it'll thrive. I just spend way too much time on Twitter just reading random articles which come up that way. Yeah. So that's pretty much everything. You get very, well, I don't know if good is the right word, but I've become extremely impatient. So if there's an article that in any way appears to be quite unimaginative and quite cliched, I'll just stop reading it straight away. And I've now learned that there are just certain publications you never have to look at. So anything ever written on Forbes is a complete waste of time.
Yep.
Sorry about all the media deals that I'm I'm screwing over by saying this, but it's just a personal opinion. Things like Fast Company, I think, is actually quite a lot of recycled crap. Anything that's written and appears to be sponsored by a company, complete nonsense. Even things like Harvard Business Review, actually. Like, I feel like the quality of that has declined. Whereas on the other side, anything that's in The Atlantic appears to be amazing. There are particular authors, so it's not a surprise, but people like Rory Sutherland or Scott Galloway, people like Derek Thompson, Maria Konnikova, there are people who every time they write something, you feel like you've learned something remarkable and that's worth reading 10,000 other articles. What I love about all of those writers is they tend to sort of bring together ideas from disparate worlds. So they'll be sort of combining a theory from coding with a theory from behavioral science with another theory from, I don't know, architecture or design or something. And I think it's that sort of altitude of thought, which I find completely compelling, and the degree to which we're often learning from peripheral and adjacent industries, which are not our own. It's a kind of world away from the kind of Deloitte Digital piece about how 5G will change everything that goes through the same examples of smart cities and the Internet of Things and self-driving cars. And, you know, that piece kind of almost looks like it's written by an AI every time you read it. So I think there is a skill to getting people's attention quite early on. And I think it's a quite traditional journalism skill of the sort of the notion of a headline that sucks people in.
So I've just remembered you just sat with the master of that, didn't you? Seth Godin.
Yes.
Didn't you just interview him or
something?
I saw.
Yeah.
What was that?
So I got asked to interview him by his publisher. which is quite an interesting experience. He was very media trained. I mean, you kind of felt like you were on a sort of conveyor belt, really, even though it was just me on it. But I mean, he's very, very, very good at articulating thoughts in a condensed way. I mean, there's a whole interesting conversation here, which is how do people create content and do thought leadership for the modern age? And what should people strive to do to create their own personal brand? And I don't really like that whole world, but I think it's interesting to have something novel to say. Like, I
think
people.
You're in it. I think you're in that. I've said to you before, I think that, you know, that whether you choose to embrace that or not, different thing. But what Seth has done, I guess we've learned over the last 10, 15 years is, he's kind of saying some really smart common sense things, but presenting them in really nice, digestible ways. And he's very presentable and articulate and charming or charismatic or something. And that's a thing.
That will get you most of the way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating because I do quite a lot of events now where I speak at events and I listen to people and I also program events. And you realize that the really good speakers are actually not often people that have the most credibility in the field. And they're often not people who've had a particularly successful career. So I would never want to listen to a CEO of a kind of Fortune 500 company speak. And I think there's a lot to be said about the skill in communication and the skill in getting people's attention. And in particular, the skill in the modern age of making points very clearly and quickly, because no one really has an attention span.
We're doing really well at that. we're way over. I'm flashing.
Feeling pressure.
It's flashing.
Feeling pressure to keep listening.
We'll link. I should have said this already five times, but you're listening to Media Snack Meets. You can go to mediasnackpodcast.com to get the full show notes, which we will link to some of the many resources that Tom and many of the writers that Tom's been talking about.
Faris Yacob as well as another one. Sorry to interrupt.
But
Faris is brilliant. And he wrote basically everything that's contemporary today in about 2002, which is quite strange to me.
And he's literally committed himself to delivering this message, right? Isn't he literally like traveling the world?
Yeah, he's one of these sort of digital nomad
funded
types.
His speaking and writing.
Yeah.
Good for him. Right, so Tom, so advice for marketers. But let's think particularly about media directors, right? And you and I know a bunch of those. So dealing with change, if we are in the interim of things and there's lots of change kind of happening, what, from your perspective, what's your advice on how to deal with that? What have you seen how people can deal with change in the best way?
Yeah, I think the main thing is to focus on people a lot more. Like, we become very introspective in this industry and we tend to focus at technologies or processes. Just look at people, like, look at how they're behaving, look at what their expectations are, look at what they would like from us, and focus only really on that. And that means actually saying no to a lot of stuff. Like, the reality is that you don't need to have a voice strategy and a VR strategy and an AR strategy and a 5G strategy and an AI strategy. You could just focus on...
Is that true?
You heard it here first. Just focus on doing really simple things well. I mean, like, we have this thing called a mobile phone, and every single person who we're interested in talking to is on it endlessly, all the time. And we still haven't found a way to connect with people there. I mean, that's a huge opportunity. Another one is e-commerce. Like, for some reason, we think that our jobs are about a spreadsheet like brand awareness or favorability or, you know, brand recall. Actually, like, we're really in the business of selling stuff. And, like, you can now buy anything from anywhere on the planet with the touch of your finger. So we can't be afraid to take areas like that and really, really explore the hell out of those as well. So focus on people, focus on doing simple things that matter, focus on your own mission. I think often clients don't really know why they're innovating. Like, some clients are doing it because they want to get famous and win a can. Some clients are doing it because they want to get famous and get promoted. Some clients are doing it because they think they can get better business results that way. Some people are doing it because they want to look busy. And I think it's important to genuinely know why you're doing it, because then you can optimize around those particular sort of criteria. And then I think finally, like, don't get overwhelmed. Like, there is this pervasive sense that the world is changing faster than ever and that everything we learned before is nonsense. And it's not really true at all. I mean, pretty much every core principle of advertising, if not every single core principle of advertising, is exactly the same now as it was 100 years ago. And actually, the effect of a sort of beautiful story that's well told or an experience that feels compelling and emotional and exciting, like, those principles are all the same. We have slightly different ways to do that now. So we can use things like dynamic creative optimization, or we can use the programmatic stuff we were talking about before. But the reality is that that's kind of the weeds. I mean, like, the most important thing really are sort of principles that we've always understood before.
Give us some hope then. If we look back in 12 months' time, if we were sat here again and looking back, what would you hope that's happened in... Let's think about the media industry specifically, yeah, which is going through this like wrangling kind of crisis at the moment.
Well, the context for that hope is that our jobs have never been more important. There's this horrible sense that somehow brands are less important or they're dying, and that's just complete nonsense. Like, brands have never been more powerful and more valuable. And as choice proliferates, like, brands become even more valuable. And the technology that we have makes our jobs much more exciting. Like, if we were an architect and someone invented steel, like, that's a pretty good day to be an architect. You know, we have all of these amazing new tools, and somehow we're not enthusiastic about it. So the thing I would love to see is I would love to see us being more imaginative in how we bring together this stuff in a way that is more helpful to people. You know, the reality is that people need advertising in their life, and they need to make decisions they feel more confident about, and they need to be told about products that are exciting and different, and they need to buy stuff. So we have to stop being sort of defeatist, and I hope we can get to a place where we just start making really great advertising experiences, and we start having ads that do not ask you to click to find out more about a type of olive oil, and instead let you click to add it to your shopping basket. So I think we'll start to see in the next year some of the sort of green seedlings of a new advertising environment, and one which we could call the post-digital age. And it's one rooted in more confidence and more persuasion and more premiumness and more consideration for the kind of way that people want to see advertising.
Sounds like a very good solution. Tom Goodwin, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Who would you like to meet on future episodes? Please let us know at mediasnackpodcast.com, where you will also find previous guests, including leading media executives from companies like P&G, L'Oreal, Mars, and many more. Plus some of the industry's most provocative thought leaders, people like Professor Mark Ritson and Gary Vaynerchuk. You can subscribe to get new episodes each week. And if you liked this episode and you think somebody else would, then please do share it. Thank you so much for listening.